We're holding on Samach Amud Beis, 13 lines from the bottom. We had a piece of Agada over here, and the last thing was we talked about the Avim. We said that the Pasuk in Parshas, the Pasuk in Sefer Yeshua mentions areas of Eretz Yisrael that Yeshua and the Jewish people hadn't conquered, and among them it mentions Chamesha Sarnei Plishtim, the five lords of the Plishtim, the five main cities of theirs and their territories, and then it mentions six, because it mentioned five Plishti cities, and then it mentioned the Avim. So we said, what are the Avim doing over there? So one explanation we said was that the Avim are less important than the other ones. So the important ones are five, and then in addition, you also have the Avim. Then we said, though, a second explanation. According to that, the Avim are Plishtim, they're just a less important group of them. Then we had another explanation that the Avim were actually from Teman. They were descended from Teman, a grandson of Esav, and they moved to Plishti territory as we learned yesterday. One thing we said was they wanted many gods. They weren't satisfied with their own. They wanted the Plishti ones, and therefore they moved to Plishti territory. You would ask, by the way, I mean, why would they do that? Why would they move hundreds of miles just for that purpose? First of all, I mean, we have to remember that the Yetzirah, Father Desire, was very powerful in those days, but more to the point, why couldn't they just do it where they are? In those days, the Goyim had a notion that gods are tied to a particular geographical area. You find sometimes in Tanakh, you find echoes of the Goyim thinking that way, that a particular god is limited to a certain place. So therefore, so if they want to worship the Plishti gods, then they have to live in Plishti territory. That was their mentality. I actually once came across an interesting idea. Someone once explained that Sancheiriv's conquest, we have Sancheiriv rules over, and his predecessors and successors ruled over a vast empire, the Assyrian Empire, and they're conquering all kinds of places. So that started breaking down this mentality. How could a person think that a god rules only over a certain area when you have there the Assyrian Getchkas seem to rule over much larger areas and overpower ours? So that began the process, of breaking down by the Goyim this notion of different gods for different places, and it started paving the way towards eventually when Likre told them B'Shem Hashem, when they'll recognize that there's one Hashem who rules over the whole world. When we talk about, maybe when the Gemara talks about, for example, Hashem wanted to make Sancheiriv Gog Magog and make Chizkiyah Mashiach, maybe that's part of that. Had Chizkiyah lived up to it, then that process would have been complete. It wouldn't have just be that old idea of those broke down, but it would have been completely replaced by belief in one Hashem who rules over the whole world. Anyway, continuing to talk more about the Avim, the Gemara says, Amar Rav Shimon Lakish, how in the crows should Uyan Lisrif? There are a lot of psukim in Torah that on the surface of it you would think ought to be brumach. There doesn't seem to be a need for them in the Torah. It seems like a gnai, it seems like a shameful thing on the face of it that they should be together with Kedusha. Accept that since they are part of Torah, then we realize there is something special to them. Let's the hein gufei Torah, and yet they are actually fundamental things of Torah. Let's give some examples. When we say Shiruyim Lisra, if there were old editions and old manuscripts of the Gemara that have a word in here, Kesifrei Minim or Kesifrei Mirus, meaning they should have been burnt like books of Minim that are supposed to be burnt, or Kesifrei Mirus, which is a few different meanings of what Mirus is. One interesting idea, it means the books of Homerus. So in other words, the idea is the comparison would be, you know, you look at Homer's poems and you have a lot of geographical and historical and everything information. Lahavdil, these psukim in the Torah look like that kind of thing as well. So why would we even bother having them in our holy Torah? And yet, Rish Lakish says you should realize the fundamental things of Torah, and we actually can learn important things from them. So, for example, one of them is involving these Avim. The Pasuk says in Parashas Devarim, Avim ha-yoshim b'chatzedim ad Azim. The Pasuk is the Avim who lived in unfortified cities. As far as Aza, so the Pasuk goes on to say the Kaftorim, who came from a place called Kafto. There's different possibilities where Kafto is. Some place in Egypt, some place in Turkey, some say that's Crete, an island in the Mediterranean, whatever. The Pasuk says the Kaftorim came and conquered them and overpowered them and destroyed them and settled in their place. So you'd have to ask, am I Naftalon? You know, who cares what happened with the Avim and the Kaftorim? So the answer is like, Mida Ashbe Avimelech Avraham, because generations earlier, Avimelech, the king of the Plishtim, had besworn Avraham that he said, we're going to make a peace treaty and we're a non-aggression pact. If Tishko Liu, the Ninu, the Nefti, if you will, meaning that you shall not, behave unfaithfully, against me or my sons or my grandsons. So in other words, Abimelech is getting Avraham to swear that he won't fight against Abimelech himself or his people or not the next two generations after him. Now, when the Jewish people came into Eretz Yisrael, you had the Avim, who was still that third generation. Among them were grandchildren of Abimelech. So what are we going to do? How should the Jewish people be able to conquer that area? Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, Lesu Kaftorim. So what should happen then? What's going to happen is the Kaftorim are going to come. They're not from the Plishtim. They're a different nation. The Litku Me'avim. They will seize the land from the Avim. They will conquer the Avim and take their land. The Hainu Plishtim. And as we said before, the Avim are a branch of the Plishtim. And then the Litku Me'Kaftorim. And now the Jewish people can come and conquer that territory from the Kaftorim because there's no problem. The Kaftorim are not descended from Avimelech. And therefore the Jewish people never made any promises to them. So in other words, Rish Lakish is telling us, that Pasuk is telling us, and if you lived at that time, you would have seen these things in the headlines, and the Kaftorim overwhelm Avim, and what does it matter to me? But now we understand that actually matters because it means the Avim are not able to be conquered by the Jewish people and the Kaftorim are. So therefore, you have an example. Now, Rashi points out that this is according to the opinion before that we said that the Avim were Plishtim. What about the opinion that we said that the Avim are descended from Esav? Very well, Hashem had also said, don't fight against Esav. So the same thing, if the Avim are descended from Esav through Teman, then the same thing. The Jewish people wouldn't be able to fight against them, but once the Kaftorim take over their land, then the Jewish people can fight against the Kaftorim and conquer them. Rashi points out there's a number of other psukim in Parashas Devarim that also talk about this land used to be inhabited by this nation, and then this nation, and then this nation conquered it. And mentioned by Seir, and by Moab, and by Ammon. So there also you have these kinds of things. When Hashem promised Eretz Yisrael to Abraham, he promised him the lands of 10 nations. So in the end, the Jewish people conquered only 7 of them. One of those nations, though, one of the 10 is called the Rephaim, which means the giants. So now the point is they're passing around Har Seir and Moab and Ammon, which all were previously inhabited by Rephaim, but each one of them, the Pasuk makes a point of saying that even though it's called Eretz Rephaim, nevertheless this is not the one that Hashem promised to the Jewish people. These ones are reserved for Edom and Ammon and Moab because they're relative. In the case of Ammon and Moab, they're descended from Lot, who was Abraham's nephew. In the case of Edom, it belongs to Esav, who was Abraham's grandson. So therefore, Hashem gave it to them, and when Mashiach comes, then we'll conquer them, but not yet. So the Torah needs stress by each one of them. Only when we come to the land of Sichon and Og, only then the Torah tells us how you call it Eretz Rephaim. That's what's called the Eretz Rephaim, which Hashem promised to Avraham, to the Jewish people, and now the Jewish people can conquer. So all those psukim over there that talk about the former inhabitants of these countries and the inhabitants of them now, all of them tell us how Hashem fulfilled his promises to Avraham again. Continues Rish Lakish, Kayotze B'davat Omer. Here's another example from a pasuk from last week's parasha. Ki Cheshbon Ir Sichon Melech HaEmori. Here the pasuk says about Cheshbon that it was the capital of Sichon Melech HaEmori. Vehu Nilcham a Melech Moav. But going on, he had previously fought against the king of Moav and captured this territory. So again, you would ask, my Nachman, who cares? Who cares about the world events like that? Why is it important for the Torah to record? Same idea. Hashem had told the Jewish people, do not harass Moav, do not fight against them. But Hashem wants that this territory, which used to be part of Moab, is going to become Jewish territory, is going to become the lands of Reuben and Gad and Chatzi Shevet Menashe. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, Lesi Sichon Lipit Mi Moab, so let Sichon come and wrest that territory away from Moab, and defeat them and take over that territory. Now the Jewish people can come and wrest it and conquer it from Sichon, because there was no mitzvah to not fight against Sichon. We see in last week's parasha when they came to Edom and they asked for permission to go through, and then the king of Edom refused them and came out with his army, then the Jewish people just went around. And in Haftorah, Parshas Chukas, it tells the same thing. Yiftach informs the king of Moab, the king of Ammon, the same thing when they came to Moab, the same thing when they came to Ammon. They didn't set foot in any of those territories because they weren't allowed to. But on the other hand, when it comes to Sichon, Sichon also refused them passage and brought out his army. And in that case, then they went and fought him and defeated him and killed him and took over his land. Why the difference? Because Hashem had told them not to fight against Edom, Ammon, and Moab, because again, they had territories that had been promised to Avraham and were given to them as relatives of Avraham. On the other hand, Sichon's territory, there was no such thing, and therefore they could take it over. So that's the point. Thus, Rav Papa tells us in other places in Shas that Amon and Moav became clean through Sichon. So Sichon took over territory from Moav, but also Rashi points out, you see from Sukkim, that some of the territory he captured was also from Amon. So now, again, those lands would have been off limits to the Jewish people to conquer, as long as Moav and Amon owned them, but once Sichon conquered them and took them over, then they're now free for the Jewish people to take. So that's the importance of us knowing that Cheshbon was that's the importance of us knowing that Sichon had fought against the king of Moab, because then that tells us how this territory is now able to become Jewish territory. So that's an example again of one of these psukim in Torah that just seems to be recording for us secular history, and there seems to be no importance to it, but Rish Lakish points out to us, you actually see when you look into it a little bit that there's vast importance to it. Here's another example. The Pasuk says about the Pasuk talks about that the borders of Eber Yarden go all the way north, all the way north to Har Hermon. Nowadays you have the Golan on the edge of the Golan Heights on the border with Syria. You have Har Hermon over there, so that marks the northern border of the land of the 2.5 Shevatim. So now the Pasuk says Sidonim Yikru L'Hermon Syrian. So thereafter it mentions until Har Hermon. So the Pasuk says you should know that Sidonim call Hermon Syrian, and the Pasuk continues that the Emorim call it Snir. And different Pasuk mentions that another name for it is Sion. So why is it important for us to know what the Sidonim and the Emorim call this mount? So here, like this, Tana, we learn in the Brayse, Snir v'Syrian mehari Eretz Yisrael. Snir and Syrian are mountains in Eretz Yisrael, meaning, in other words, it's not that these are different names for the same mountain. These are actually different mountains in that range. Hermon is closer to the Sidonim. Snir and Syrian are in Eretz Yisrael proper. But it means that the Sidonim, even though their neighboring mountain is strictly speaking the Hermon, nevertheless they called it Syrian, and the Amorim called it Snir, because they wanted to say the importance for it. They built cities on this mountain. They built cities on this mountain range, and one group called their city Syrian after the mountain in Eretz Yisrael, and another one called their Snir also after the mountain in Eretz Yisrael. Malamach Galachavacham Umasolam Holochavonalai Krach Godalatzma. So each one of these nations built themselves a big city in that area, the Herolosh Al Shem Hore Eretz Yisrael, and named their city after the name of a mountain in Eretz Israel. The Lamdacha, which teaches you Shafila Hore Eretz Yisrael, Chavivin Ala Umasa Olam. It teaches us that even the mountains of Eretz Yisrael were precious to the nations. They considered Eretz Yisrael such a special place. They didn't think of it as a holy land necessarily, but they knew that it's such a blessed land that they wanted that their cities in other places in the world should be named after even mountains in Eretz Yisrael. You know, you have a similar kind of thing. Look up how many cities in the United States, for example, are named for places in Eretz Yisrael. So it's the same idea. In other words, they had a love for Eretz Yisrael, and they realized how important it is, and they named their cities after it. In a similar vein, by the way, the Medrash says, as far as the 31 kings that Yeshua and the Jewish people conquered and killed, that to have 31 kings in a small land like Eretz Yisrael, each one of them actually ruled over a territory outside Eretz Yisrael, but each one of them also had a palace in Eretz Yisrael, because in those days you weren't considered anything important, you weren't considered a significant king, unless you also had your own place in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore these 31 kings, that each one of them is a king of a different country, but as a king of a part of Eretz Yisrael, then they were conquered and defeated and killed by Yeshua and company. So the same idea, we see how important Eretz Yisrael was to the Goyim in those days. Nowadays also, unfortunately, we have that they're constantly fighting us and claiming that we don't own it, but that's a whole other matter. Here's another example of a pasuk that seems to tell us information that we don't need to know, but we actually learn something very important from it. The pasuk says that at the end of parshas Vayigash, it tells about what was going on during the famine in Mitzrayim during the couple of years after when Yosef is already in charge, of course, but Yaakov and his family haven't come yet, and the pasuk describes how the Mitzrayim ran out of money and ran out of food and everything, and finally they had to sell their land to Paro, where from now on they're going to be paying them a tax of the crops, and the pasuk says the Esha'om Hever Oisil Orim. The people of Mitzrayim, he moved them by cities. He took the people of one city, and then Yosef, and made them resettle in another city, and he did that throughout Mitzrayim. So my nafkamina, again, why is that important for us to know? And the answer is, Zulalikula F of Galvosa. Yosef intended with that. He knew that eventually his family are going to come to Mitzrayim. So he didn't want that they were going to call his, that they were going to make fun of his family and call them exiles. Oh, look at you. You're not where you belong. Well, you know what? None of the Mitzrayim are where they belong either. Each of them has been moved city by city to a different place. So that's the importance of us knowing that pasuk of what Yosef did as far as moving around the population of Mitzrayim. Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, by the way, in his commentary, he has a couple of interesting points about that. First of all, he says Yosef didn't want to destroy the bonds of society that you have within each city. You have different levels of society, friendships, relatives, and whatever. So he wasn't going to break them up just randomly. He takes an entire city and moves them elsewhere. They still have their same bonds of society. They still have their respective people who are higher up in this city are going to be higher up in the other city or whatever. So, but on the other hand, this way they're not in their original native city, and that way they're not going to make fun of the Jews who come later on and say that you're not in your right place. And Rav Hirsch goes on to say a similar idea. He says in his time, the popular anti-Semitic expression was "Jew, go back to Palestine where you belong." Nowadays, the other way around, they claim we don't belong there, but whatever. Anyway, back then, the European anti-Semites would say that. So, what are you Jews doing in Europe? Go back to your land. Well, so Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch points out, you know, if you look in European history, you find the ancestors of the present-day European nations also, there was a whole migration of nations all over the place, the Huns coming from Central Asia, and the Anglo-Saxons coming from England to Germany, from Germany to England, and the Visigoths and whatever coming from Northern Europe to Southern Europe and so forth. So Rav Hirsch says, if a goy tells you, go back to where you belong, then ask him, what about your ancestors? Have they always been here? Hey, okay. Fine. So now we're finished with the piece of Agadah, now getting back to Halacha. We said in the Mishnah, Simonim ha'oifloi nemru. We said that the simonim of animals and a fish are clearly stated in the Torah. Okay, as far as animals, we talked about yesterday, do you actually need a masoda on an animal to eat it, or is it automatically, if you find that it chews cud and has split hooves, then it's automatically kosher? Fine, but at any rate, it mentions those two simonim clearly in the Torah, and it mentions clearly in the Torah the simonim of fish. But birds, the Mishnah said, it doesn't say the simonim, and then the Mishnah had gone and given us four simonim. So the Gemara says, "Velo, you're telling me they're not said in the Torah." V'hatanya, we learn in a Braisa, the first bird on the list of non-kosher birds. Again, you have this list in two places, in Shmini and in Re'eh. The first one in both places is Nesher. So therefore, we can make a binyan av from it and learn that all non-kosher birds are somehow similar to the Nesher. Now, what is a Nesher? So the usual translation of a Nesher is an eagle. Tosfos points out a couple of blocks further along on Daf Samach Gimel that based on what the Gemara is going to say over here about the simone tumah that it has, it doesn't really seem to fit. In particular, we said in the Mishnah that one of the simonim of a kosher bird is that it has etzba yisera, an extra toe, which we talked about a couple of possibilities what that means. Tosfos points out an eagle does in fact have that. So therefore, there are a number of Rishonim who learn that actually the Nesher would be some type of vulture. What is special about a Nesher? It doesn't have any of these four simonim that we said in the Mishnah. It doesn't have an Etzba Yisera, whether, as we said before, we understand the Etzba Yisera to mean one toe higher than the other toes on the back of the foot, or whether it means that the middle toe on the front of the foot is longer than the other ones, and Nesher doesn't have that. The zefek, it doesn't have a zefek, the crop, the pouch in the middle of the neck that we learned about before earlier in the parak, where the food first goes to start getting broken down before it goes down into the gizzard. The ein kukavonin mikloch, it's gizzard, its stomach, the inner lining of it is not peelable. The dirtus of oichel, and a nesher is dirtus and eats its food, which we talked about in the Mishnah, a couple of possibilities what dirtus means, that it tears off pieces with its talons, or that it eats its prey while it's alive, and a couple of other possibilities that we shouldn't bring up of what dirtus means exactly. In any case, a nesher has all of those four characteristics, tomei, and the Torah tells us that it's tomei, that it's non-kosher. Therefore, you learn therefore, you learn that any similar bird that does not that doesn't have any of these simonim is non-kosher. Now, Rashi points out that the Gemara is going to go on to say that all the other non-kosher birds listed in that section do not have all four of these. So what do we mean? So what exactly are we including with that? What do you mean, afkol kayotzeboi? So Rashi says, fine, it would mean anything that's in the category of nesher, other things that are in the, each of the, many times when the Torah tells us a species, an animal or bird, it includes subspecies, just like we talked about, for example, previously about the deer, that it includes the tabby, the Beiloi, the deer of Beiloi that we talked about on Nun Tesama days. So the same way, in other words, each of the same way, when the Torah tells us a certain min, it can include other related minin as well. Other really, in other words, the definition of a min would not be the same as a species in modern taxonomy. So Rashi says, what we mean is over here, we're including all the other different types of nesher, because otherwise, all the other ones do not have all four of these. Tosfos objects to that, and says that no, there can well be other minim other than the nesher. So Tosfos explains what the Gemara is saying is that in other words, later on the Gemara says there are only 24 non-kosher birds, and that's why the Torah lists those 24 to say that all other birds in the world are kosher. But Tosfos says no, what it means is that when we have those 24, we can recognize that through them, once we realize there's simonim, then we'll be able to recognize any other bird in the world that is non-kosher. In other words, maybe it doesn't actually mean that there are only 24 non-kosher species. But nevertheless, though, the fact is there are more kosher species, and therefore the Torah prefers to keep the number shorter. Anyway, so Tosfos says that what the Gemara means. Well, so that's what it means. Ach koka yotzebo tome. It means, in other words, that indeed there can be other species that don't even fit in the category of nesher. As long as you find that they don't have any of the four simone tara, then it means that it's non-kosher. Now we're going to talk about soon. What about all the other birds in the list that have only some of them? We'll get to that point soon. Anyway, the Braisa continues. Also, now the Torah also tells us that there are kosher species of birds. The Torah mentions turtle doves. We learned earlier in the Masechta, they have two types of doves that can be brought as korbanos, doves and turtle doves. So turin, we can learn from turin, also we can learn a binyan av from them. The fact that you can bring them as a korban means automatically it must be that they must be kosher to eat, because you can't bring as a korban anything that's kosher to eat. So we can learn from turin. They do have this extra toe, or this long toe, however we learn it. The zetek, they do have a claw. The cook of a nickel, they do have their gizzard can be peeled. The ain dos in the oakland, they are not dirtus and eat, to hurt him, and they are tahor, ask for kayetzim, and to hurt him, the same way any other bird that has those characteristics is tahor. So now the Gemara is going to point out soon on Omer Bey is a contradiction. So what is it? Are we learning from Nesher that only if it doesn't have any of the four of them it's Tzrefa, or are we learning from Turim that only if it has all four of them is it Kosher? We'll deal with that soon in the Gemara. But in any case, the Braisa is saying that we do in fact learn from the Psukim in the Torah about the Simonim of birds. So why is the Mishnah telling us that Simoniho, that the Simonim of birds are not given in the Torah? They are. They're given by implication. Rabbi says that's what it means. The explanation of specifically what are the four simonim, it doesn't say explicitly in the Torah. It's only medivrei sofrim. The Chachamim figured it out by analyzing the psukim. Unlike, in other words, the simonim of behemoths and chayas and of fish, where it says explicitly in the Torah what they are, all we need to do is we need to just translate what does mafresis parisa mean, what does malagera mean, what does snapper and kaskesis mean. But here, you don't even have, the Torah doesn't mention the fedrish, any simonim at all, and left it up to the chachamim to figure out based on the contrast within the nesher and the totem, which ones what are kosher and what are not. Because once it mentions Turim as a paradigm of the ones that are Tahor, and it mentions the Nesher as a paradigm of the Tmeim, then we can realize by looking at their anatomy that they're different in these four things, then that tells us that those are the four Simone Tar. Those are the four Simone Tumah and Tar respectively. Tosfos says, explains a little differently, that the Gemara's understanding that there must be, at least the Torah mentions a number of times about Torah and Bnei Yonim being used for Korbanos, there must be at least one of those places where it didn't have to say the word Torah, and it's extra, and therefore we have it available for this Jerusha. So the Gemara says, Tony Rapiya, so Rapiya teaches us a Braisa, Oif HaBob, Simon Echad, if we have a bird that comes before us that has only one simen tara tohar, then it is tohar. It's kosher to eat. You have to be able to recognize that it's not one of the ones mentioned in the Torah, because as the Gemara is going to mention soon, there are some of the birds that are on the list that are that have only one simen tuma, and nevertheless they're also to eat. So we can't say as a blanket statement that if it has one simen, then you are allowed to eat it. But it means, in other words, as long as you can recognize that it is not one of those species that I mentioned, then you'd be able to eat it. Because your Priya says Lafisha ain't doing the Nesher, because then in that case it's not similar to the Nesher, because the Nesher we're saying has the Nesher we're saying doesn't have any of these simonim. So if it has one of them, then it would be fine. Nesher the less like klal. So a Nesher has nothing at all. Who would like teichel? They're not allowed to eat. Ha'ikah de isleichad. But if it has one simon tara teichel, then you are allowed to eat it. So they want to ask for leilach miturin. So why don't we learn? So now the Rambam brings from the Gaonim actually that they have a Masoda that even if you have simon echad, only one simon that by itself would be enough to make a bird kosher would only be when the gizzard can be peeled. But if the one simen is that it has a crop or that it has an etz b'yisera, or let alone that it's not dirtus, then the Rambam brings from the Goyim that wouldn't be even a priya wouldn't mean that that's kosher. So if you have there's this one thing with the peelable gizzard, but pashtos the idea would be, in other words, that if it has that kind of thing, if it has that kind of lining on the gizzard, then it means it's not a meat eating animal, it's not a predator. Okay. So the Gemara says, why? So you're telling me that we're learning from the Nesher, that because the Nesher has zero of them, therefore any bird that has one that's mutter to eat. But why? The Leilach miTorin. Maybe we should learn on the contrary from Torin and say, Ma Torin di Ika Kulu, Arba. With Torin, you have all four of those simonim. As Hothanami ad di Ika Kulu Arba. Maybe you would say that for a bird to be kosher, it has all four. Why are you learning Dafka from the Nesher and saying that as long as it has at least one, which makes it unlike the Nesher? Say on the contrary, if it's missing even one that's unlike Torin, then you can't eat it. And the answer is in Kain. Shar Oifus Tmein, because of Rahman Alomali, if that were the case, then why would the Torah need to list all the other non-kosher animals, non-kosher birds? None of the other ones are missing all four simone tuma, simone tahara. The Gemara explains that out of the 24 that are in the Torah, 20 of them have three simonim. The orev, which is usually translated as a crow, but we'll talk about soon, has two, and then there's two that are mentioned in the pasuk peres and osnia, which each have one. So if, in fact, we would learn from Torah, you wouldn't need that whole list, because then you'd say, none of those have all four simone tahara. So that means, in other words, that in fact, as long as they have only some of them, then they could, so we're learning primarily the Binyan Av from the Nesher that doesn't have any of them, and therefore the Priya can tell us that if it has some of them, then you are allowed to eat it, as long as we know that it's not one of those ones that have only some of them that are listed in the Torah. The Rashba takes out the word sha'ar, that the question would not really be so much on all the other ones. The question would be really on, if we wouldn't need a list of non-kosher birds at all, instead we would just learn from Torim. But the Rashba says that's not really, you can't really learn only from Torim, because then you wouldn't know what simonim are going to be the key ones. The whole point is you need the contrast between Torim and Nesher in order to be able to determine what are the simonim tahara. But fine, the question would be that it could have listed only Torim and only Nesher, and then we would say that and we would learn primarily from Nesher that as long as it has, only when it has zero of them is it Terefa. So that's how we know not to learn from Torim, we know to learn from Nesher because of that. Okay, the Gemara asks for Nelech Minayu. Taka, why don't we learn from the other ones, all those other 20 birds? and say that because each of them have three simone tara, and nevertheless they're not kosher, and we would say mahos and tlos of leachinen, just like with 20 of them, they have three simone tara each, and yet we can't eat them. Afko tlos of lenechol, the same way even any other bird that has only three, you can't eat. But kosher can trey, and kosher can trey v'chad, how much more so if it only has two, or if it only has one? So why don't we learn that way? Why is Rav Chiya telling us that one simone tara is good enough, when we could learn that way, and we could say that it means that a binyan ab, we would say that even three of them is not good enough. Now, Tosfos points out that the Gemara at this point could answer, because then you have many times, you have many extra psukim in that case. The Torah does not have to list us 20 birds that each have three simonim, if it needed only one of them for that kind of limud, and 19 of them would be extra. But the Gemara is going to give a better answer. And Tosfos also explains that the question itself is somewhat different as well. That after all, we could have learned that maybe these 20 non-kosher birds, the ones that simonim of tara that they have, are not good enough. You need other simonim. And then the answer is that it didn't. And the Gemara is going to give an answer. So the answer is imkain. If that were the case, Orev, the Kosser Rachman Alomali, why would the Torah have to write the Orev, which has two Simone Tahara? Hashtag the Isfei Tzlosa Le'achman, and you would make a simple Kavachim. If you can't even eat ones that have three Simone Tahara, the Isfei Tzrei Midboya, would you need to tell us that you can't eat the one that has two? So therefore, if the Torah is telling us that you can't eat the Orev, which has two Simone Tara and two Simone Tumah, then that means we can't learn from the ones that have three Simone Tara, that for three Simone Tumah, that in fact, that those are the ones you can't eat. Therefore, in fact, we can't learn from them. And anyway, as Tosfos points out, you would have a lot of repetition among them. There'd be no need to list all of them. And therefore, that brings us back to the Priya's din, that even if it only has one Simon Tara, then it's kosher to eat as long as you recognize it's not on the list. Again, as the Rambam says, that one Simon Tara would have to be appealable korkavan. What an Orev is also, here also Tosfos further on Daf Samach Beis discusses what the Orev is. The usual translation of Orev is the crow, or is the raven. But again, Tosfos points out that it doesn't really seem to work because it doesn't fit with the fact that Gemara is saying over here is two Simone Tara and two Simone Tumah, and the ones that Tosfos were familiar with don't have that characteristic. So there are, in fact, sometimes they translate Odom as crow, sometimes as raven, and each one of them has various subspecies in it, so it's possible that there's a b'chal, by the Odom anyway, the Torah says laminoi, that according to its kind, meaning that there are a lot of subspecies of Odom, so some of them, so the translation of Odom may not exactly be crow, but it may be some similar kind of bird that does have two simone tumah, as the Gemara is saying over here. B'chlal, that's the problem with a lot of these birds that I'm mentioning in the Torah. We don't know how to identify them definitively, which is why, in the end, we're going to learn in the Gemara in a couple of blocks, you need a masoda in order to eat a bird. You can't just say this bird is not dirtus and has an extra toe, etc., and therefore I can eat it, because you need to know that it's not one of the ones that are listed in the Torah, or one of those subspecies, and we have no way of knowing that. As we see that even with a lot of these common ones, everybody figures the Nesher is the eagle, and yet Tosfos is saying that it's not. Everybody figures that the Odev is the raven, and yet Tosfos is saying that it's not. So the same idea. Okay. So anyway, the point is that we would say that if in fact the din was that you're not allowed to eat any that have three simone tumah, then there would be no reason to mention the Orev, which has the 20 non-kosher birds that we're saying, 20 out of the 24, have only one simon tumah, they have three simone tara, and yet you're not allowed to eat them. If we were going to say that we learned from that, then there'd be no reason to mention the Orev, which has two simone tumah. Okay, so the Gemara says v'loy lech ma'orev. Maybe indeed we should learn a binyan ab from the Orev itself. Ma'hosim trei lai af kol trei lai, and make the rule that where any time that it has two simone tara, you can't eat it. The same way any other bird that has only two simone tara is not kosher, but it would be that you have to have two at least. Not like Rav Chiya is saying that it's good enough to have one. Tosfos points out the Gemara at this point could answer that because by the Orev it says laminoi, and it wouldn't be necessary to say laminoi, that it has subspecies, that would amount to shnei psukim boim ke'efod. It would be two psukim that teach us it's the same thing. And we don't learn from that, but again, the Gemara is going to give another answer. Im Cain, if that were the case that we learn from the Oreb, Peres va'oznia dekos rachman alamali, then why would the Torah have to list the Peres and the Oznia among the non-Toshav roads? After the Nesher, the next two on the list are the Peres and the Oznia. So again, there's different possible translation of what the Peres and Oznia are. The Gemara mentions later on that they're characteristic of them, that they live in faraway places. So we shouldn't even give different possible translations of Peres. The Peres may be a bird called in English the ossifrag, which literally means bone breaker. It's a predatory bird that breaks the bones of dead animals that it finds in order to eat them. So that would be one possibility. And as far as Osnia, actually one possible translation they give of it is the osprey, which is a water bird. It's a type of hawk that eats fish. So if now the Peres and the Osnia each have, as we're going to go on to say, they have only one simon Torah. So Peres and Osnia, the Kosev Rachman Alamali, why would the Torah have to mention them? If you were going to say you were going from the Oreb, Hashem Isle Kirei Laichlin, if you're not even allowed to eat the Oreb, which has two simon Torah, the Isle Chad Midboya, would you need to tell us about the case where it has only one? It would be needless to say. We would learn it from that Kavachoyer. So therefore, we can't say that we're learning from the Oreb that you can eat it only if it has two simone tara. And in fact, we're back to Reb Chiya's din that even if it has only one simon, that you know, only one simon tara, then it can be kosher. Okay, the Gemara asks the Dikin of Peres Vaznia. Well, very well. Why don't we learn from the Peres and the Vaznia and say that they have one simon tara and you can't eat them. So therefore, the rule would be if it has even one simon tara, even if it has one simon tara, you can't eat it. And not like Reb Chiya says. So the Enigma of Peres Vaznia, why don't we learn a binyan out from them? And the answer is that could act in Cain, Nesher, the cause of Rahman Alamali, then why would the Torah have to have listed the Nesher, which has zero of them? Hashtag the Isle Chab Layachlin, and if you can't even eat one, the Peres and Osnia, the Lesle Kamid Boyer, what do you need to say about one that has zero, that you couldn't eat it at all? So in other words,
you can eat them except for the
24. But the point is, we can't learn. So we said we can't learn a binyan av from the 20 that it has to have three. That it has to have three of them. So you can't learn a binyan av from the 20 birds that you need three of them, because then there's no need for the Oreb. You can't learn a binyan av from the Oreb that you need at least two, because then you don't need the Peres and Osnia. And you can't learn from the Peres and Osnia because have one, and say that even one is still not kosher, because then there'd be no need to mention the Neshin. Now the Neshin, we said at the beginning, the Sugya has zero. Again, whether the Nesher is the eagle or the vulture or whatever, that's the thing. Tosfos points out it can't be the eagle, because the eagle hasn't answered the Yoseda yet. But here's where Tosfos pointed out. On Amud Aleph, though, the fact is that you do need to mention the Nesher anyway, because you need to have the contrast between the Nesher and the Turin to know what the four simonim are anyway. But fine. The point is, in other words, that we could have, even if it just said Peres and Osnia, because... as the Gemara is going to go on to say, the Peres and Osnia, even though each of them have three simone tuma, they're different by each one. So putting them together, you have all four of them. So you could have learned that way, and you wouldn't have needed the Nesher, which actually has all four simone tuma. So that's how it is then.
What's the other bird that we bring on the carbon, the yayna?
Turim and Bnei Yayna, yes.
So I didn't bring Bnei Yayna.
But I guess we're mentioning Turim because they're mentioned first each time in the Pasuk. So the Gemara says, so based on all of that, Ella, so now having gone through the logic like that, we realize, Nesher, the less like Kvalu, the like Tehful, the Torah is telling us, the Binyan Av is learned from the Nesher. So the rule will be Nesher Galas Le Kfal Hud Le Techel. A Nesher has zero Simone Tara. That's the kind you can't eat. But if it has one, then you're able to, as long as it's not on that list of non-kosher birds. Okay. So the Gemara says, Ve'el Taim the Kosev Rahman and Nesher. Okay, but you're telling me only because the Torah mentions Nesher, and therefore we know not to learn from Peres and Osnia. But you're telling me if it didn't say Nesher, you would argue, as similar to what Tosfos had said before, that we should in fact learn from Peres and Osnia. The question is, how could we? Then it comes out that it's two psukim, or two words in a pasuk, that teach us the same thing. that any time you have a brood with one simen tara, then it's non kosher. Well, shneik suma boim kachad and malamdin. And we have a general rule that you can't learn from two psukim that tell us the exact same thing. Why? Because again, you have when it comes to if you have one thing, then you learn a binyan av from it to everywhere else. But once you have two, then it means it's limited only to those two and nothing else. So therefore, see, even without the nesher, we would know we can't learn from the peres and osnia. Why do we need the nesher after all? And again, like Tosfos is saying, Yitaka don't even need the nesher at all because now, well, the Gemara is going to answer now that the peres and osnia have different simone tuma. So the answer is Gmiri, because we have the Kabbalah. The Gemara elsewhere mentions an opinion of Rav Yehuda that you could learn from Shneik Sulamba and Kaf, and you just can't learn from three. But here the Gemara is talking according to the Chacham. Okay, so the answer is Gmiri. We have the Kabbalah. The Ika Bahai Leka Bahai with the Simen Tara that Peres has is not the same as the Osnia has. Or the Ika Bahai Leka Bahai and vice versa. The one that one has, the other one doesn't have. So if the Torah had written. So if the Torah had written only one of them, then you wouldn't know the other. Then you wouldn't know the other sin.
One for each one.
So therefore, so in fact, it didn't say nesher. We could have in fact learned that any bird that has the simonim of the peres or the osnia is non kosher, and therefore we do in fact need nesher to learn that it means that when you have zero of them then it's tereka, but if you have at least one of them then it can be kosher provided that it's not one of these. So the Gemara says mechti. Well, let's consider esrim vabo oifas tmeim havu. The bottom line is there are 24 non kosher birds. Efshad the chad the ikah bahanach leka bahani. Impossible that you should have that not one of the simonim that you have in the peres and osnia is not going to be by one of the other ones. At least it's not logical that it should be that way. So then, at least in that, the havelahu shneiks from a boyim kachad. So relative to that, at least you have shneiks from a boyim kachad. Meaning, in other words, let's say for example, among the four simonim, let's say for example, one of them is that it has a zefik, that it has a crop. So you're going to tell me between the peres and the osnia, you're going to say so each one has only one simen tara, but it's a different one. But fine. Let's say the peres has a crop and the osnia doesn't. Fine. But among all the other birds, you're telling me not one of the other ones has a crop. It's going to come out there, it's not going to have a crop, rather. So therefore, at least as far as that, it's going to be shneik suma boyim kachad. So again, it didn't need to say nesher, and you still couldn't learn a binyan av from the peres and the osnia, and we would still be left with that, in fact, you could learn even without them, that a bird with one simen tara is kosher. So Tosfos has a long discussion of what the Gemara means exactly, and the fact is, what about Tosfos says? Look, you need the nesher to tell us there's a simen that neither the peres nor the osnia have, only the other ones have, and you wouldn't know that that's a simen without having mentioned the nesher. You're going to say, okay, maybe that one is found in the Oriv, then fine, but nevertheless. And Tosfos goes through a long discussion over here and discusses another explanation of the sugya. Tosfos explains that the Gemara had thought peres and osnia are called shneiks and maboyim kachad because if you're going to learn from them that one simen is enough to make a bird tome, then the Torah could have told us only one of them, not the other one, and we would understand about the other. Then you would say, but what about though the peres has only the one simen, maybe only that one is tome, but the osnia has a different simen, and that one would be tome. But no, the fact is you have that by the other birds as well, by some of the other birds as well, and therefore so you would say that you need it to be together with another simen in order to be tomei, or even with another simen that's tomei, how much more so by itself? And then we go on and we explain why that wouldn't be shneiks or maboyim kachad. So the one answer is like this. Maybe we have the Kabbalah. There are 24 non-kosher birds that are listed in the Torah. And now there are four simonim of Tara. Slosa hadri b'kodu. There are three of them that repeat throughout all of them. Namely, Esrim mehem shloisha shloisha. There are three, the 20 of these birds have three simonim Tara each. So they have only one simon tumah. Otreba Urev. The Urev has two of them. Chad the Peres and Chad Bosnia. And the Peres and the Osnia each have one simon Tara. Which the Isse Baha, Lesser Baha, and we said that among the Peres and Osnia themselves, each one has a different simen tara. So now, therefore, mao detect. So now, in other words, the point is, so now there's no shnei suma boim kafan, because now we have that there's one of these four simonim that applies to only one of these 24 birds. Mao detema leilach minei. So now you would think to learn from that, that even if it only has that one, that it has only that one simon tara, it should be, you know, that one simon tara, we should learn that it's osur, and then we would say that, and then we would learn by a kavachomer the same, if it has none of them. And in practice, then we would have to say that almost all birds are not kosher, because we wouldn't know what is that simon. We would say we have 23 birds over here without the nesher, but you wouldn't know, you wouldn't be able to identify what is that one simon that makes it not kosher. Kosher rachman and nesher. Therefore, the Torah has to write the nesher, which then we have the binyan av nesher delesley klal, where the nesher has nothing at all. Who delay teichol? That's what you can't eat. Ho ikad delesley chad. But if you have ho ikad the isley chad echol. But if you have one of them, if it has at least one of them, then you can learn it, provided that it's not on the list. So that is why we actually need the nesher. We can't just learn from the peres and the osnia and the whole rest of the list, because then we would be left in the dark as to what exactly are the simone toma and simone tar. Okay, so the Gemara says, Ela toden dekosa rachman olamali. Okay, but why then in that case? Once we establish that really fundamentally we're learning from nesher, what are the simone toma? And we're saying that we can do that by comparison with all the other non-kosher birds. So after all said and done, why does it have to say Torin? We're not learning from Torin. And you can't say that we need it legufoi, because Torin have all four of them, and when we just finished establishing that even one simantara is good enough. And the answer is Omar of Okubach, Omar of Korban. So the Okubach says, you're right. The fact that it mentions Torin is only the fact that they can be brought for a Korban. You're right. You're not actually learning from it that anything about the Simone Tara, that you learn exclusively from Nesher. But the fact is, if the Torah hadn't told us Torah, you wouldn't know. That's kosher for a Korban, but it has nothing to do with, one second. So like this, when we started the Sugya, Rashi explains that we mentioned Nesher versus we mentioned the Torah. So we thought that meant that we actually learned from the contrast between Nesher and Torah, we learn one of the Simone Tuma and Simone Tara. Now we're saying it's not so. It gives us a simon, but it's not actually, we don't learn the simone tumah from there. Rather, we learn it from the comparison between the nesher and all the other birds. Then Rashi brings a girsa that there was a question, then why did the Tana even mention Torim? For what purpose? And the answer is no. Then what would be the answer of a korban? Then you could say the same thing. Chickens might be able to be used as a korban. They have simonim as well. But no, the fact that the Torah repeats over and over again, Torim with Nayona, means those are the only two species that are kosher for a korban among birds, no others. So the question was not what, the question was not as far as for what halacha did the Braisa mention Torim. The question is then, fine, the Braisa mentioned Torim, but it's not that we actually, the question is, why does the Pasuk mention them if we don't need it in order to learn the Simone Tumah and Tara? And the answer is to tell us that they can be brought as a Korban, and to tell us it's only Torim and Benayona that can be brought as a Korban. But you're right, as far as the Simone Tumah and Simone Tara of birds, we don't need that. We can learn exclusively from the Nesher and the other non-kosher birds by comparing their characteristics. You want to ask them?
You answer.
Yeah.
But basically, the idea of Torim is not to say that you need all four to be a Korban.
After those,
the bird that has all four,
it's not kosher for a korban, right? That's Rashi's last point, that you're not going to say, for example, that chickens are kosher for a korban, because they also have four of those simonim, because the fact is, the Torah repeats over and over, Torah and Ben Ayona, meaning that it's exclusively those two and no other. Yes.